Welcome to Dominate for Two, a War Machine and Hordes podcast.
I'm Alex.
I'm Mark.
And I'm Benjamin.
And today we are doing a list check-in. It's been a while since we've done one of these, but the purpose of these episodes is for us to share what we've been playing, what we're liking, and why, and also to give the listeners, you know, some context on how we're thinking about problems, the particular lens we're coming from, and, you know, just share some tech that may not be all the way out there yet.
Yeah, especially after the Kator episode, I think people want a little bit of a window into the what the hell we're thinking.
Exactly. Mark, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, so I haven't really changed my Madrak list in a while now.
Well, I think you've changed it since we did the last piece-by-piece breakdown of what's in the list and why.
Okay, yeah. So I'll still do it. Yeah, so I'll just do a quick rundown through the list. But that's Madrak, Runebear, Glacier King, Lanissa Rissel, Champs with Scaldi, Raiders, two sets of Bears, Creel Stone with Stone Scribe Elder, and Valka Curseborn. and so previously I was running a two champs variation with no Raiders, and before that I was doing, double Fire Eaters instead of champs or Raiders. So, but the one set of champs with Scaldi was always there. And I just found over time that you need an AD unit to not just get completely screwed going first as trolls, because you need to be fueling your stone, you need to be casting your spells, yada yada yada, and you could just get too punished if you had double champs, and raiders or fire eaters just weren't enough bodies. It's higher damage output, but not enough bodies.
So you were finding you go first. You do all your fueling and spell casting and so forth, and then you just don't have enough up there?
Yeah, so I do some match tracking to like try and figure out where I'm doing things right, where I'm doing things wrong. And I noticed that my Madrak list at tournaments had a literal 100% win rate, like not exaggerating. Like if I went to a con and Madrak double champs went first, I won 100% of the time. There was no losing. But if I went second, it was like a sub 50% win rate. It was abysmal. And so I experimented with Raiders because I wasn't happy with the Fire Eaters back when I played them at LVO. It felt like not enough bodies. And I've ultimately settled on Raiders, and I'm very happy with them. They take even ground very well. You don't particularly care whether or not they're in Creel Stone. The difference between Arm 14 and Arm 16 isn't huge.
And they've got, if you are going first with your Creel Stone, you can get them up to speed 7, and they have a 15-inch walk and bomb throw. They're bodies that can get in the way and block for your bears, you know, etc.
Yep.
Is that actually, like, solving the problem for you?
My win rate's getting better going second. I need more games with it, but I was happier with it pretty much every time I played it at Lock and Load. And that kind of segues into how I changed my off list. I was playing Kolgrimah, a very assassination heavy list, and that list was just an absolute beater. Like if you did not have a good answer for it, it would just like top of two or bottom of two people, like reliably, just over and over and over again. But it had a bit of a hard matchup into Scorn. It didn't love Osram, and I've been running into a lot of good Osram players, namely Jeff Everett and Corey Doyle. And so I felt like I needed something to pair with Madrak better, because I think Madrak across the field is better. While Kolgrimah is more oppressive in the matchup she's good in, she's not necessarily a good coverage list for Madrak.
It's interesting, because like Kolgrimah for me was one of the biggest stumbling points in evaluating trolls as a matchup. And, you know, we didn't really cover this on our Kator episode, but like she's a gigantic problem for Kator, you know, especially when you consider that there's probably, like, if there's Kolgrimma, there's probably also a Storm of the North list with ubiquitous cold immunity. And so a lot of Kador's assassination out tricks don't work. And you have to design, you know, and a lot of factions are in this place where you have to design for a lot of either infantry or battle group problems or whatever you're designing for. You will often have to answer the entirety of trolls in a single list. And Kolgrimma makes that a huge problem with her ultra strong assassination. So I'm curious, like, where, you know, you mentioned Scorn and Osram, like, where did you find the list was falling down? Was it not performing into intended matchups? Because it seems like a really big sacrifice to make there to give up, you know, a caster who just, like, puts your opponent through contortions like that.
Rishet Double Turtle can be really tricky for it. And I found that theoretically you can play Madrak into that list, but it requires a lot of brain power. And like at Lock and Load, my last round, and I might have top eight and got some points off of this, I was put into a Rasheth pair. And I was just like, I do not have the mental fortitude right now to actually play Madrak correctly into this. And so I put down Kolgrimma. And it was a close game, but it was just frustrating. And I'd rather have something that can handle Rasheth just fine. And then Kolgrimma, there's certain flavors of Kricks that aren't theoretically well-liked, like for Madrak, like Scar. I think people overestimate how bad the matchup is for Madrak, but I think it's not great. It's a game, but it's not like a slam dunk. And Kolgrimma, I don't think she wants to play into Gatsby 3 particularly. Maybe with some better positioning. But the more I play into that, I just get trepidation.
Because the Slayer nonsense, like, they're way cheaper than your heavies, and it's like two of them to kill one of yours. And
yeah, I'll style on Denny too, but Gatsby 3, I think, is one of those games that it's doable, but again, it requires you to be on your game. And when you're playing in like a 5+ round event, you don't want to have to play literally perfectly to have a good matchup.
Yeah, that's something I definitely experienced, like playing Scorn in Mark II, for instance, is, yeah, you can play into theoretically anything if you play literally perfectly all the time. Like, you can play into Veil 1. You just have to make literally no mistakes the entire game.
Easy peasy.
Yeah. So good. Okay, so you've jumped off from Kolgrimma, and what is the list you are running now?
So right now, I'm testing the Grim 1 Creel Company list that's been taking trolls by storm. I forget the name of the player in Europe who originated it, and Jaden brought it into prominence at Lock and Load this year. And I'm not quite sold on it yet. I'm having a really hard time telling whether people have no idea what's going on and it's just turning the game into clown fiestas, or whether it's a legitimately good list. I can't tell you. After playing, I'd have to go back through my logs, but I've probably played it about a dozen times at this point, and I have no idea whether it's good or people are just confused.
So the list is Grim Angus.
Yeah, so it's Grim, Runebearer, Sea King, War Wagon, Hooch Hauler, Fell Caller, Fire Eaters, Swamp Gobbers Bellows Crew, and I feel like I'm forgetting something, but
it's like Braylon Feralgeist or something like that.
Or okay, so he plays a slightly different variation on the list with Minstone, so that he can fit Braylon in. I don't. And he runs a Minpig Lookout unit instead of Fire Eaters. The Minpig Lookout might be better. Like, it has some nice synergy with the War Wagons because of Mark Target, and they can ambush, which means that they'll get around problems with
if you have to deal like, with spread so, the
safe
net
solos, spread the net. Yep. And so I'm probably going to be trying that next. But I think in general, the list is just one of those things that's like so wacky that nobody quite has any clue what's going on. And I think that's driving the success more than anything else.
So it's been successful so far, and you just have to determine like whether it's people are not acclimated to it at all or whether it's genuinely good. So what is Grimm adding to the whole picture there? Because that's kind of confusing to me.
So his feat is, what's it called? Minus three def, and then models storing their activations inside of it, minus three speed, and can't charge or make power attacks. So you can basically control how people engage on your battle engines. And then on top of that, it also makes it super easy for the battle engines to hit on that one turn. Like they're going to get onto whatever they want to be on, and it's just going to die.
Right. They're rat 8 or 10 or higher at that point.
Correct.
Interesting. And that gives you a really potent assassination, especially if one war wagon hits, they're down. And then, you know, you can dump Grimm's shot. Grimm's already gone by this point, but you have Grimm's shot, you have another war wagon, you have the Hooch Huller, and you have the Vomit Spray, and you have incidental attacks.
Correct. And there's a lot of continuous effects, so you can randomly kill infantry. So, turn one, you position aggressively. Turn two, you kill as much stuff as you can get away with, and you put a bunch of ARM 21 huge bases in scenario-relevant positions where your opponent can't really charge or do much melee damage, and see what happens. at least that's what I've seen so far. This kind of goes back to my point of I kind of feel like people are just weirded out by what's going on with the list. After playing a bit, I feel very strongly that Jaden once won twice against Osram at Lock and Load. I think that matchup is borderline unwinnable for Grimm. If you had two people who had played that matchup 100 times, like I feel like it would have gone like 70 plus times to the Osram player, like once they knew what was going on.
So it doesn't really solve your Osram problem necessarily.
Yeah, it kind of feels like there's a lot of wacky stuff going on, and there's a lot of knowledge that your opponent just doesn't have. And I don't mean like holding rules back from your opponent or anything.
Or
but
how
they
return
just like
fireworks.
Let's not get into that. But I think that it's so out there that people don't quite have a good model for what the possibility space is. Because like in War Machine, a lot of how you play the game is you try and figure out what your opponent's going to do on their next turn, how much damage they can do, how far they can threat, whether they can kill your caster, etc. And then use that model to make your decisions. And if you've got an entire blank slate across the table from you, you have no idea how much output, you have no idea whether they can kill you or like how far they can threat. I mean, like you can figure out how far they can threat, but if you like don't have a good feeling for like how far they can meaningfully get in on you, then you're going to give away stuff that you shouldn't be giving away if you actually know what's going on.
Right, so like familiarity and just knowing how a game goes against an army that's basically four huge bases, like that is an odd challenge to face, and it's not something that's in most people's daily game experience.
Yeah, and I feel that this is kind of why assassination has kind of gone way down from what it was like in Mark II, is because pretty much every assassination list out there is relatively fair. Like they're not busted, right? Colgrima's numbers are a little bit on the absurd side.
Yeah.
But she can't reliably kill casters just by herself. You need a little bit more incidental damage to have a above 50%er, which means if you can stay out of range of Mulk and whatever that follow-up piece is, you're probably going to live an assassination run, which is part of the reason why I've moved off of her. Whereas like in Mark II, you had stuff like Veil, like she was getting on you. There's pretty much nothing you can do to hide from it. Like, and you just got to pray. And the game, like with pre-measuring and all these other elements, it means that there's like no surprise factor in guesswork anymore. So you can't just like have an opponent not like realize how far you can threat and then, or like try and gamble on like staying out of your 19 inches without measuring. You know what I mean? And so in an open knowledge game, like, you can know anything, any distance between any two models, any of the rules, all that stuff. The only thing you don't know is the dice. Dedicated assassination lists are just worse.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
I do an assassination, it's virtually always because I've bullied my opponent to the point where they have to risk their Warcaster or Warlock to do enough work to try and make a comeback. And they just have to gamble that they don't get killed on a pretty decent odds assassination.
You're not sucker punching anybody right out of the gate or going in with, I'm going to get you on turn two or three. I'm going to make you take some serious risks that will give me an opening eventually.
Yeah, and like Kolgrima can do it, and like I would reliably like get locals with Kolgrima, but once you go to a con and you're playing against like really high-end tournament players, it's just super hard to pull one over on them. Like, even if they haven't seen it before, they've like played enough games that they have like a good idea of what the possibility space is, and they'll ask you for all the important numbers, and then they'll just play correctly. And so I think Grim is just like, it's so far out of people's comfort zone that nobody has any clue what's going on. Like, I feel like I want to try and, I don't even know. Like, I need to find like a better practice regimen, because like, I feel like people are just so weirded out by Grim that I'm not getting good information.
That makes sense. I mean, I think if you give it another month or two, you'll probably start to see that less and less. But that's definitely like when I first started playing Drake Spam in Mark II, that was definitely a problem. Like, it was difficult to get good test information. Weirdly, it was difficult to get good test information even at cons because most people had never faced anything like it. And the shape of the game shakes out differently when you're facing an opponent who's experienced against that or prepared to play it. But yeah,
I have a good example of this. So I was playing into one of our locals, shout out to Scott, who's playing Crucible Guard, and he was playing, he had a Locke Lucas pair, and he played Lucas into Grim twice. It was once or twice. I think there was a rerack in the middle. I can't quite remember. But he just like lost super hard. He's like, I don't know how I beat this. And then like we played Locke, and good God, she's a hard counter to that. She's just like a hard counter to Gargantuans in general. Because the Vulcan, it's speed 6 base. You put red line on it the turn before you're going in. So it's speed 8. It runs 16 inches. Then you onto their Gargantuan, which in this case was the Sea King, it does dice damage at power plus strength 21 before any debuffs like Dragon's Breath or Rust or anything, which they almost assuredly have. And it puts out its no healing bubble, and then it just takes out your spirit and just sits there. It's like, you literally can't kill the Vulcan. It's going to kill your Gargantuan next turn. And I can't remember the last time I've had a matchup that much of a hard counter. But Scott, until we actually played it, he was just like, I have no clue how I'm supposed to beat this Grimlist. It just wasn't working. Because he was trying to like shoot me down with infantry and like do an assassination with Lucas. And it just wasn't working. And then he turns around and he plays Locke. And it's just one of the most brutal beatings I've had in Mark III in terms of just like raw matchup.
Yeah, he just had your number with that particular piece of tech, and it really broke it down for you.
Yes, yes. And so I think that's definitely informing my opinion of skepticism about the list. Is I wonder how many people are putting down the wrong list. I wonder how many people are coming in with the wrong game plan. And I need more time exploring it. I'm trying to put in as many reps as I can to get a good picture, but it's wacky.
And then do you know where you're going to go next? Like, if the Grim thing turns out to be a flash in the pan, like, is this going to be back to Gunnbjorn or back to Kolgrima?
Gunnbjorn's a very attractive option. He supports a Hoochaller very well. So I think there's actually a good Storm of the North. I could run double Storm of the North with him, or I could go back to old POD, or I could even put him in Creel Company because he has access to Dozer and Smig, who has Lucky Shot as an Animus. Which it turns out is really good on both the battle engines trolls have. But one of the troll dojoers I chat with a lot, a big fat troll on Lormal Hordes, shout out, He's been playing around with a Storm of the North gunny list that I actually don't hate. So it's Gunny, Dozer, Smigs, Bomber, Runebear, Fellcaller, Hero, Swamp Grubber, Chef, Volca, Max Creel Stone with UA, Double Bears, Max Raiders, Hooch Hauler.
So you got Veteran Leader, you got options for Snipe on the Hooch Hauler or on the Raiders, which give the Raiders like a 19-inch danger zone. That's pretty impressive.
And you can put Snipe on the Hooch Hauler, so you have a 12-inch cask bomb, or you can put it on the Raiders, yada, yada, yada. But you can actually run a very, if you want to go more like gunline focused, you can run a very similar list to this in Creel Company, which will give you plus one to start. The only meaningful changes you would have to make is replace Volca with something and replace the two sets of bears with something.
Because everything already fits in that theme.
Yeah, everything else is legal in the theme.
Interesting. So that's where you're going to go if the experiment doesn't work.
Yeah, and then you have RFP tech, so you don't... There's a lot of people who always... I don't want to say get bad at me, but they very heavily criticize me because I don't have any like serious amount of RFP in my pair. But Gunbjorn, he has Explosivo. And if you have a couple of good sprays with him, then you're Gucci.
And, you know, I don't think RFP is as big a problem for trolls as people seem to make out, especially into something like Ghost Fleet, where it's principally coming off of melee attacks. Like, there's some recursion in the game, but I can't think of a lot of areas where it's absolutely essential. So, I mean, I think you're making the right choice there.
Yeah, like, it's annoying with Scar 3 because she just gets good turn out of turn value, or turn over turn value.
Mm-hmm. But you can also snack if you're playing Power of Dunya into it, or any War Beast, really.
Yeah, like, we have a lot of living RFP, but, like, for if Convergence Infantry becomes a huge problem, or theoretically Ghost Fleet, but I feel like modern Ghost Fleet isn't that much of an issue. Maybe it's just because I've played so much Kolgrima, which, like, will not lose to Ghost Fleet, except if you're playing the double Earthborn version. That was a bad time.
But the bombers make it good.
Yeah, bomber with a Bugtrog Mistspeaker so you can see through the stealth on her. It's really hard for Denny to contribute meaningfully and not die. Because by definition, if she's feeded on Molg, then Molg is in spray range of her.
Oh, but yeah. That's bad.
And I think Grim is also similar, not like a ton of super duper high armor stuff. And you can pretty reliable, you have Mark for Death, so you can take away Incorporeal. The Creel Stone can take away Incorporeal. You can take away Stealth. Jamming doesn't matter because the War Wagons have that rule where they don't need to go 3 inches to make impact attacks, and they have 3 dice to hit. So even under Denny feet with -2 mat, they're going to rip through all of your infantry.
Yeah, especially if you counter feet.
Yep.
You're at a net +1.
And you have +1 to start, so they don't get to pressure you as reliably. But enough of my grand ramble on trolls. But the TLDR is Madrak is as great as always. Borka, too, is still great, but I'm not playing him. Trying Grim, I think he's overhyped, but I don't know where I'm going.
So for me, I just recently went through a faction swap, and this is one of the great weirdnesses of War Machine that's often not always transparent, is the metagame changes all the time, but whether it changes for reasons of novelty seeking or reasons of things not being competitively valid, it's not always apparent. I'm going to say straight up, I am changing from Scorn to Protectorate for reasons of novelty. I was previously playing Zadesh 2 and Morgul 3 and tooling around with variants on Morgul 3 to iron out some of his specific matchups into Krix and a couple other places. And then the Exemplar CID dropped and I just really wanted to explore that. And I have a large amount of Protectorate that I got from my brother Nick, who was on our episode on leaving the game.
Hint, and he left the game.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Although that's another one. That's another one where it's like, oh, novelty seeking. I'm going to go fight in an armored combat league. It's great, though. That's totally what that's like exactly the thing Nick was born for. But yeah, so I picked up Protectorate with the advent of the Exemplar CID and Caveat. One of the lists I've been playing is a CID version, so whenever that drops, it's unclear when, my army may change, because this has just been getting experience with the revisions in anticipation that it's going to land pretty close to this.
Hopefully before the Classic.
Yeah, hopefully before the Classic.
Quick shout out for all of our listeners. I just want to take a second here. NorCal Classic, August 4th, Mountain View. Come on up or down or west or east, I guess, if there's Hawaii players. I don't know what the Hawaii War Machine scene is like, but we really need a Hawaii War Machine Con, as an aside.
I like that idea.
Aussies, get out here August 4th.
Why don't we move War Machine Weekend there?
To Hawaii. I think you would see the attendance drop pretty precipitously.
Yeah, but all the attendees would have sick-ass tans.
True.
Sorry, back to what you were saying.
Oh, okay. So I switched over to Protectorate. Fingers crossed the CID drops before our point series event. So I actually started the game with Protectorate like 14 or 15 years ago. And I was never any good at the game back then, but I loved running Exemplar. And I love the aesthetics of the faction. And then, you know, I did an army swap with my brother in Mark 1. He continued playing them in Mark 2. So I'm picking up Protectorate for the first time in at least 13 years. But I have like 200, 300 games into Protectorate, playing against my brother like almost every day for 2 years. So just a lot of experience playing against them and seeing what works in a faction that has not changed a ton over time. So I'll just dive into the list and say more of what I mean, because, you know, both these lists are archetypes that I am, you know, they're slightly changed, but they're archetypes I'm familiar fighting against for a long time in Mark II. So the CID list I've been playing is Harbinger with two Devouts and a Redeemer. This is an Exemplar Interdiction. Gravis, a Bastion Seneschal, the Piper, an Exemplar Warder, a max unit of Errants with the UA, a max unit of Bastions, and two units of Standard Knights.
The fact that you don't have all four of the unkillable solos deeply disappoints me.
One of the things about Exemplar Interdiction is there's a lot of expensive models that can go into it, and the Knight Seneschal has really good personal output. The Warder is a great mix of survivability and output, but they're expensive. And with Harbinger, if you really want to, pretty much any of your models can be unkillable. So I mean, like, this is Dojo, but if I was looking at doing something like that, it would probably be with Sirenia or someone else. Who doesn't have the same kind of crazy sweeping defensive abilities that Harbinger does.
And most importantly, has Inviolable Resolve. I don't think we've talked about this tech on the podcast yet, so I just want to do a quick aside into it, because I'm really surprised that nobody's been, like, talking about this.
Two Warders, two Knight Seneschals with Sirenia.
Yeah. Or Krios 2. Like, both of them work. So the Warders and the Knight Seneschals, they have the same ability. I can't remember the name off the top of my head.
Inhuman Resolve.
Inhuman Resolve, which is really confusing because you put Inviolable Resolve on them.
They're so full of resolution.
Yeah, oh, there's going to be a very fast resolution to the game if you do this. But if you put Inviolable Resolve on a Warder or a Seneschal and you put it into an opponent's zone or contesting an opponent's flag, it physically can't die until the start of your next turn, and they can't push it, which means that the only way that they can actually score that flag or that zone is if they have TK, if they have a model that can throw, or if they have consume. And so there's certain lists that are just like, well, I guess I'm physically not scoring this turn. And you have four solos that can do that. So you can basically deny four CPs guaranteed in certain matchups. And I think that's absurdly good. Like, if you weren't playing Protectorate, and if I wasn't super happy with my trolls right now, I would just, like, go back and buy all the stuff, like, all my Menoth stuff that, like, got stolen at LVO a few years ago. And I would just, like, start styling on people. It's, so obnoxious.
Yeah, especially when you put, like, Desperate Mission on one of those Seneschals or Warders, and Inviolable Resolve actually makes the Warders arm 20, which is doubly frustrating. But I am not running that. So the Harbinger list I'm running is basically just a crapload of Weapon Master guys. You get the extended deployment zone. You have Crusader's Call. You have Desperate Pace. They're relatively quick. I just want to mention the changes that were done to the Errants in the CID. Again, no idea how many of these are going to stick. But Errants were a faction-defining unit for Protectorate in Mark II. And they were one of the premium units in the game. Like, when you were talking about dealing with early-game skirmishers or serious business units, you were almost always talking about Satixis Raiders and Exemplar Errants. The reversion to Quick Work and picking up Native Pathfinder, like, on a warrior unit, Quick Work is so much stronger than Assault. Because it means they can go into your opponent, do a bunch of damage, and then fire attacks in deeper. Or if your opponent comes into them, they can keep themselves alive with self-sacrifice and martyrdom and effectively always trade up. As long as that unit is in melee against other warriors, they're going to be getting more than their value out of whatever exchange happens. So Errants are particularly potent, and taking them from like some really bottom barrel stuff at the start of Mark III back up to, you know, they don't get Hunter again like they had in Mark II, but like they're quite formidable.
And they don't just have generic spell ward, right? They didn't give that back in the CID.
No, they have a mini feat for it. So like the unit is reduced probably down to what I would call a fair point rather than an obscene one, but I think they're strong enough to, you know, just displace things like Idrians, you know, whenever the two are, you know, can be taken in the same list. You know, the Harbinger list is basically all about momentum, stalling out your opponent's attacks, and just enabling these high-powered warrior models to do work over and over and over and over and over until your opponent runs out of stuff. I prefer this over something like Faithful Masses because every model in the army is a credible attacker. It's not like I'm limited to a small handful of guys who I'm relying on all my output. Like, basically everything in the army can mangle or destroy a heavy warjack. So that gives it a broad range of things it can fight into. Between Crusader's Call and Desperate Pace, the army is fairly quick to engage. And with Tactician, the army is also hugely tactically flexible because it can activate backward to front and never stop seizing ground.
Yeah, I also love the fact that her feet went up to 12 inches as well, because that means if you toe into a zone, it's physically impossible for somebody to... Well, for rectangle zones, it's a little bit off. You have to be, like, slightly in, but it shouldn't be that hard. It's impossible for a throwaway solo or infantry model to contest your zone. They have to put, like, a light or a heavy in if they want to stop you from scoring. And I think that's just such a nice little bit of quality of life, because it makes, like, her ability to just, like, control a scenario element that much more reliable.
And one, I realized I forgot a unit just sitting here thinking about it. I also have Visgoth Roven and Honor Guard in the list. So that's
Vygoth.
That's another feature of the list that you don't see in something like Faithful Masses, where, you know, you're taking a wall to give Harbinger a place to hide. This army has 5 shield guards in it, 3 of which can be martyred. And my experience with that has been that Harbinger is a really secure caster under those terms, also with 2 sources of the spell immunity coming off the Devouts. You know, as long as I'm not forgetting to do the leaving one in base to base with her, like, she's really hard to kill.
Don't forget Guard Dog.
Oh, yeah, and the Warder, if you put his Guard Dog-like ability together with Awe, Harbinger is def 18 in melee against living models. So that's not an all-the-time situation, and often if your opponent's getting the melee with her, you're in some deep trouble, but like when your caster starts at def 18, that's a really good place to be.
Yeah, it's a very strong stat profile to keep yourself alive.
Yeah, so that's the Harbinger list. I started playing that during the CID, been, you know, keeping up practice with it, because I'm pretty sure I want Harbinger and Exemplar Interdiction. Basically, however the CID shakes out, you know, as long as Errants or Bastions don't get re-destroyed by the final version, I'm fine with it. And then my other list, and it took me a while to actually find a partner list that I wanted to play with. You know, I'm... experienced playing against Protectorate, but not so much with it. So it's been kind of a journey of discovery to find something that, okay, what are Harbinger's actual weaknesses in this configuration? What do I need to be covering? What do I need to be thinking about? You know, because Protectorate has a lot of problems that Scorn doesn't, or at least the Scorn list I was running. So thinking about matchups I haven't had to think about in months has been interesting. But the second list I've come to is a caster who I think is hugely underrated right now and has been basically this entire edition. But when I was playing in Mark II, he was, you know, my brother's favorite caster, just really solid, is Severius One. So Eye of Menoth being an always-on ability is super nice, lets you camp things like Vision and stuff and keep Severius even safer than he used to be. The big thing is Eye of Menoth lets you crank out some truly stupendous numbers on offense if you're stacking on top of things that either damage stack themselves or start high-powered in the first place. So the list I have is in Faithful Masses. It's Severius 1, 2 Reckoners, Blessing of Vengeance, Vilmen, 2 Paladins of the Wall, 2 Allegiance of the Fist, Minquire, Max Zealots with Monolith, Max Idrians with the Chieftain and Guide, and then 2 Deliverer Sunburst crews. So this list is all about putting high-powered shots downfield. So you've got POW 17 shots coming off the Reckoners. You've got POW 15 or POW 13 Immolation or Ashes to Ashes coming out of Blessing of Vengeance. The Idrians start at POW 14 against their prey target, which is really solid, or even POW 12 and combining up to 14 against non-prey. So they're actually reasonably threatening things that don't have a token next to it. The Sunburst crews, if they aim, go to Rat 8, POW 16, which is quite substantial. And the Zealots hit at POW... like, basically, everything hits really hard. And the army has the ability to just put, you know, crippling damage into multiple targets at range. Like, you know, I've played it a few times now, and the way the army wants to play is pitch up to, you know, basically somewhere around that wall template, and then just keep dumping shots forward until your opponent runs completely out of stuff. Both these lists are very attrition-centric and very grindy. The Severius list in particular, I actually got myself into a lot of trouble playing it, you know, because I found myself overthinking things, going for assassinations, worrying about weaknesses, when in reality, like, the best way forward would have been just trust the primary plan of attrition, damage my opponent's closest models, and keep doing that over and over again until they had nothing left. So, like, I had games where I went for assassination runs in the early game. They didn't pan out. We played the game 4 turns later, and I was still either winning or almost winning on attrition. It's like, oh, this would have been much better if I went for this in the first place. So the list is rock solid, mostly built around, you know, just big offensive swings and really maximizing Eye of Menoth. It's playing 2 attrition lists, and I'm sure we could have a whole episode on this. Both the armies are very grindy, but that Severius list and to a lesser extent the Harbinger list are almost brainless. Like, it's actually not very mentally taxing to play. So that's something that I've also found valuable and enjoyed as well. Oh, and something else worth mentioning in that Severius list, I think just coming back to Protectorate, you know, I haven't been playing it for a long time, but I see a lot of Protectorate lists that are built, and, like, I've built my share of them, where I'm pretty sure a lot of them have too much support. Like, the Severius list has Choir, that's it. And the army does, like, serviceable work. I haven't felt myself, like, desperate for something like a Covenant or Vassals or Rax or a Hierophant or whatever. And I think it's because Protectorate has so much support, it's so easy to go down to that rabbit hole where you're spending like 20 to 25 to 30% of your list on non-business models. And I don't think it's necessary all the time.
Yeah. Though I would say if you can, I mean, I'm somebody who has pretty much only played factions where you're constantly pushing the limits of support bloat, like Trolls, Protectorate. Well, we don't count Kador. Kador was a long time ago and there was no support.
There's still no support.
By Privateer Press.
Porque no los dos.
Oh, God. I'm sure going to get that one in my DMs later. though I would say with Severius, it really does kill me when I look at your list that you don't have a Hierophant and a single rack. Because, like, I feel like 4 points is such a small investment to be able to pull the trigger on, like, a pretty good assassination if you, like, can hit with a single Reckoner or something.
Yeah, that's fair. Gosh, yeah. I think that's a viable alternative. I want to keep testing it as is, though, because, like, I'm really intent on, you know, pushing the opposite limit, like, how little support can I possibly get away with in this faction? And the answer so far seems to be, like, almost none. You know, that Harbinger list has a bunch of business models that incidentally provide support, but, like, I'm not taking them expressly for support.
That's fair.
Yeah, so that's what I've got. That's what I've been running. No big metagame change. Like, I was perfectly satisfied with Scorn and felt like the faction, you know, as I was playing it or as I was seeing others play it, could adequately cover the entire field of the game. I was just really turned on by these models that I haven't played in over a decade that I really liked. It's where I started the game, and I was just pumped about the changes.
One sec. Did you just say you were turned on by the models?
That's what he said.
Yeah.
He loves him some shoulder pads.
I love me some churchies.
Okay. Sorry. I just wanted to get that formally recognized in the record before we continued.
Guy in a priest outfit? Mm-mm.
Go straight back to your Catholic upbringing.
Okay. Well, before this gets any worse, Ben, what are you looking at playing? We discussed this a little bit before the podcast, but you're getting tempted by the Crucible Guard.
Well, they're shiny, and I like shinies. So the real shocker of this episode will be that I have to confess to everybody that basically I've quit War Machine and Hordes and been playing 5th Ed D&D nonstop, and that's basically where it is. Nah, just kidding.
I definitely had the opposite. I basically, like, quit D&D so I could spend more time playing War Machine.
Yeah. Now, so the problem I've been having is that I've been playing Signar more often than not. I don't really count my Wednesday dribbles into random factions as serious. Because, of course, I own multiple factions, so sometimes I show up for the standard game night with whatever. But I've consistently basically been running Signar at tournaments. Except for the last tournament where I took Cawdor as a sort of proof of concept thing. I mean, I hate to say that I won two games because I feel like I was dirty person for winning two games.
I mean, winning with Cawdor is a dirty thing nowadays, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, just in case anyone cares, I was playing the Zerkurva.
Oh my god, it's Zerkurva.
Zerkova 2 spray list thing, which is a list I played in Mark 2 and a list that Alex was playing quite a bit of at one point.
Yeah, this is carbon copy the list I ran at I5 with the double max spray ponies, double Turnian, Ayana and Holt with Valachev, two Colden Lords, two Forge Seers, and two Destroyers.
Not only was a carbon copy, it was actually his models.
So, yes, like, it was physically all my models.
It was in every possible way exactly the same list. But it's a list that I actually played a fair amount in Mark II. It's a list I actually liked playing. But the deal breaker, again, was the pair to it and the inherent weakness that that list has in some of the matchups. We settled on Irisk 2 as my pair. Wasn't terrible, wasn't amazing. One thing one of the games I won was just because I played an opponent who literally had absolutely no idea what was about to happen. And so that wasn't necessarily a particularly good test of how good it is.
Right. You went to 6 points on your turn 3.
Oh, that was the other. So that was the other win. So interestingly enough, in case you're following this at home, both of the lists, both of the games I won, my opponents had. I lost every single roll to go first in the entire tournament. The norm for me. I defy odds like that constantly.
I love how we call it the role to go first instead of the role to like choose, because like people think going first is like so oppressive right now.
Well, and it is, because in both of the games I won, I actually may not there's a high probability I wouldn't have won the game had I gone second. But in both cases of the games I won, my opponents deferred to be go second in order to take location, and I won the game because of that. Which also reinforced to me how desperately dependent on getting the first roll a lot of armies are to be effective. And so, yeah, so one of the wins was just a flat Zerkova assassination run. I think it was the top of two. Just, it happened. The second one was a Irisk 2, just, it was a bum rush with the Iron Fangs, scenario lockout, and I went, you know, 6-0 on scenario, because I effectively just jammed him entirely out of anything and contested. But in both of those cases, I feel had my opponent gone first, as they should have, since they won the roll, I would have probably lost those games. And honestly, the game I won with Zerkova on assassination, it was into a COC list, which I don't think either one of the lists I had brought had any chance of winning. And so I basically just went for the assassination flat out, as it was the only spottable chance at victory that I could see with either list. And it's the same thing that I did with the Iron Fangs. Like, I was playing into a Menoth list that had better attrition than me, but I knew I could swing the scenario in a way that would probably get me the win, and I was right. But anyways, I've been normally playing Signar. I have a Striker 2 as my primary, and then I've been sort of waffling between a couple of different casters as my secondary. I dinked around with Siege 2 for a while, just because I put a couple Purity Seals on him. I thought it was funny. And those lists are actually pretty good. I just wasn't that excited by them. But what's really started happening is that I'm kind of feeling around for some of the choices, because Striker 2, who is generally my answer to heavy armor spam, is having issues with it recently, not because there's anything wrong with Striker 2, but because a lot of the armor spam that's been showing up recently also has a pretty solid shooting options. And since Striker 2 in the list I've been running is leveraging the Storm Lances, the fact that I'm running into armies that are now reliably taking off two horses a turn before contact is becoming a huge issue with getting enough damage onto these big targets. And so I've become less satisfied with the list. So I've been sort of searching for some other answer. But then I run into the regular Signar problem, which is that, you know, I don't have any other particularly solid infantry option. And the Jack Spam Signar thing isn't particularly effective with Striker 2. And, you know, it's sort of left me searching around. I've been thinking about doing some other things.
Yeah, because this is, it's been a while. I know it's been an ongoing concern for you, like finding either a pair or a faction to stick with that you really enjoy. Like, I know you spent a while messing around with minions and spent a lot of time like screwing around with Signar, but not really feeling lit up by anything. And, you know, of course, like still not being happy with the place Kador is in. In fact, I think the last time I can really remember you like getting behind a dedicated pair was the I-5 like 2 years ago, when it was Signar for you, but obviously a very different metagame and, you know, just not finding something that sticks.
Yeah, I mean, because then the tools were perfect for the meta that I was seeing, and so I was very happy with the matchup profile. I mean, I think the big problem I'm looking down the barrel of right now with Signar is that, you know, there's been a lot of prevalence of, you know, Scorn Resurgence, which is great. Faction, you know, needed the help and got the help, and so it's fixed. But now I'm running into the problem that Derp Turtles are a really problematic matchup for the cavalry, because their armor profile and their threat radius, especially with the gun, is
well, also their large bases, which with the burst fire rule makes them like the ideal targets.
Exactly. And so that's one of the factions, because I'm seeing them a lot, And, you know, it's fine in the sense that, you know, like people are really taking advantage of how good they are right now. But it just shows how problematic the horse stacking is, because even with deflection, which is a fantastic spell, and arcane shield on them, if you're getting multiple shots and you're boosting damage, they only got 5 wounds. And so pretty quickly you're losing horses. And the turtles have the perfect counter threat radius to the horses. So they can normally get some shots off and then repo away. And it's hard for the horses to effectively ever get the alpha on it, especially if your opponent's paying any attention at all.
Right. Cause if they move, if they move up to get charge threat range on it, it's got charge threat range on them. And between its guns and its melee attacks can probably wipe out the entire unit.
Exactly. And it's not an outside chance. It's a very reliable chance. And unfortunately, in that list build, I just can't afford that kind of math and come out ahead. Because basically what that starts doing is it forces me to immediately start trying to lever a assassination out versus a, you know, more honest game of it. Which means that, you know, as we talked about in Who's the Beatdown, like I quickly realized that, you know, I flipped from one side to the other, and it's a problem.
And I think it's a fair mention, too, that the game right now is pretty, at least for cavalry not backed up by a dominant shooting position, there are a lot of boostable guns that will pick up cavalry very quickly and can engage them first. So, I mean, yeah, I think it's a totally fair assessment that the cards are kind of stacked against a cavalry-centric army right now that isn't backed by shooting supremacy.
Right. And like I said, it used to be that between deflection and arcane shield, they could weather the bulk of that and still get delivered. But recently, the models I've been seeing just tap the curve in the other direction, and that basically just ruins my game plan. And obviously, as this is intended to be sort of my beater brick counter, that becomes even more of a problem, because most of the beater bricks you're seeing have a lot of resilience to the traditional shooting options that Signar would bring. So it's kind of, you know, like if I'm seeing trolls, or if I'm seeing convergence, or if I'm seeing any of those, or Scorn, obviously, or any of those other beater factions, you know, it's getting harder and harder to reliably deliver the list. And my shooting pair just doesn't handle that, you know?
Yeah, because you're, I mean, basically outside of Nemo 3, it's really hard to find guns that will menace something like a Siege Animantor Axe that won't lose on scenario very quickly.
Right, and that's part of the problem is that the lists that I'm seeing are rocking both really serious melee threats plus the ability to like rapidly run up and reach something, in addition to having, you know, plenty of other presence in the scenario. And the durability of the caliber really isn't high enough to use them as a jam, right? Like I can't just run them and shove them into somebody's face and be like, hey, you got to deal with this.
Can't
like
they're not them the gym jam.
Yeah, and that used to be, you know, one of the classic Striker 2 tactics is that, you know, to arcane shield one of the units and just, you know, run feet and see what happens. But now it's just, it never delivers enough to pull off that, the work that it used to.
I don't know. It was working pretty well for Zach at the last Steamroller. But, yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it specifically in Discorn, but Ragman plus Stormlance is solid.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a bad list. I was starting to feel like it was just one of those things that more things were demanding I drop that list into it, and it was having less of a margin of success into those things. And especially with Crucible Guard now, I feel like the cavalry is going to be really disadvantaged into dealing with Crucible Guard, which I know I'm going to be seeing a lot of for the next period of time.
Yeah, that's the big change in metagame hotness right there.
Right, and that was one of those sort of, because, you know, like after having paid attention to the CID, like I knew this was going to be a problem. Like I knew that Crucible Guard would be a huge issue for Calvary. And like that's just one of those additional red flags where I'm like, well, you know, it's still a great list into a bunch of things, but are those the bunch of things I'm going to be seeing? And, you know, the answer has been more and more no, those aren't the things I'm going to be seeing. And so, you know, I was just trying to come up with some new list pair designs, and I just haven't found anything currently in Signar that makes me feel like I'm putting two solid answers on the table right now for the meta as I'm seeing it here, obviously. First, mileage will vary with that. And so, you know, I've been debating whether I should go back to Legion, which seems to have a lot of answers for some of the things I'm seeing. It seems to be all right into a bunch of the other stuff, but I'm kind of behind on Legion model purchasing, so I have to figure out what I need to get.
What about Krix?
I've been debating that as well. I have most of the stuff I need. I just haven't really felt like scratching that itch recently, so I need to figure out whether I want to go back and do that.
Yeah, because the models that got consolidated together as Slaughter Fleet Raiders, like, pretty accurately describes the kind of models you were favoring anyways when you were on your Krix phase. So, like, Blood Gorgers, to a lesser extent, Black Ogryn, just heavy reliance on living beater infantry, and then back up with some Jacks and some scaling infantry support casters.
Yeah, in case listeners didn't pay any attention or are new to this, in Mark II, I was very abnormal in that I ran a lot of Blood Gorgers with Scar 1 instead of other choices. But they suited what I was trying to do with my game style quite well, and I was fond of them. So I actually already owned two fully painted units of those. I was probably at the time like one of four people in the world that owned two fully painted units of those things.
Is there any popular tournament list that runs double now? Because I feel like the Scar 3 list is single with double, the new ones with the firebombs.
Right. I mean, it makes the most sense to run two of the Raiders because they're awesome in the new list. But I just think it's funny that, you know, for a long time, there was nobody who had that. But, you know, with the revisions, they're pretty solid. But yeah, I mean, that's what I'm basically debating. And also, I mean, I have been dinking around with again. I'm just still not at a point where I'm 100% sure that minions offer as much over coverage as I need.
Yeah, especially with Scorn being a problem. Like,
right, because,
you know,
cause
we found the Zadesh I was running at the time, like, basically hard countered pretty much anything in the faction.
Right, well, the problem with minions is that they run into two issues and potentially a third now with Crucible Guard. Is that minions have always been trolls, but slightly worse in the sense that, you know, like, you run into troll players, you guys are both doing the same thing, but trolls do all of that better, which always makes the minions in a troll matchup really, really rough for the minion player. And then also, yeah, now that Scorn are just a very good choice, they also cause a lot of issues for minions. And I also feel the Crucible Guard are getting the minion fits because they are going to be killing the minions at a very high rate. So yeah, it just sort of leaves me trying to figure out really what I want to commit to for a while, because the other reason I keep going back to Signar, obviously, is that having played them for a very long time, I'm still very familiar with positioning mechanics and everything else. So even if the list isn't optimal, I'll still probably do better with that simply because I'm much better at running it. And that if I take a list that I'm not super familiar with, odds are I'm going to do something silly. But that's basically where I am. I'm still trying to figure out what I want to spend the most time with.
And how much of that is, like, you know, because I know we've talked about the metagame thing. The big thing I'm seeing and hearing out of this conversation is it's not just the metagame thing. It's like how you enjoy having your fun. And it seems like the armies you've been playing or messing with are not quite scratching that itch.
It's a lot of also response to the metagame, just because, as Mark observed earlier, assassinating, obviously the higher you get up in the skill level, the less likely that's to happen until something else has happened. And if I'm playing a list that levers that more, it actually puts me at a disadvantage the high end tables. And so, you know, I don't want to be walking into the tournament already thinking, oh, well, you know, I'll get some easy early rounds, but then basically I'm just hoping my top end opponents derp, you know, like that's not a particularly wise game plan to go in with. And, you know, some of the new builds are shockingly assassination resistance, you know, like the Harby list, whenever that becomes legal, is just a huge ordeal to try to get assassination on.
Well, it's not like it got any easier to assassinate her or harder.
No, but the well, actually,
but she's going to be in vogue.
Before the warder made assassinating her vastly harder.
That's fair, I guess. More shield guards.
More shield guards, and the guard dog is a real big deal, to be honest.
Though, how often do you land something on her? I feel like that's going to basically never happen unless something's gone horribly wrong.
You know,
because like you're more likely to chip her down on martyrdoms. Because like, as long as she has a model in the way, she's going to keep on martyring until she dies.
Right. Well, the warder covers both angles for you between being a high arm martyrable shield guard and doing the guard dog thing. Like, those are all pretty substantial.
Right. I'm just, you know, it's like when you start looking at the math, like the math for reliable high value piece assassination has gotten a lot worse across the board into most of the what's popular.
Like right now, you've also got just a preponderance of backline support casters who throw their buffs and hang out.
Right. You also have the situation where, you know, people rightly retune to deal with the shooting murder meta. And so you're running into a lot of armies now that are super resilient to incoming shooting, which takes away a lot of sort of the like chip them down as they come in and then kill them tactics. Because like the chip damage just basically stops happening. You know, it's just a bunch of things like that that are making me reconsider where I want to be with Signarin. So I haven't picked anything yet, but sort of shopping around Tinder style.
Have you played much Siege with Kane Zero?
I don't own Kane Zero yet, so I definitely need to test that. I'll be honest, my experiences with Siege 2 were not super thrilling for me.
No, Siege 1.
Oh, Siege 1.
You just put down a, what's it called?
Fire for Effect.
Ground Pounder. You just have an AoE 5 of Murder that you get to do every turn. And, like, the rest of the list, I feel like, almost doesn't matter. Because, like, that in its, like, that old tear through champions, that'll, like, it'll go through pretty much anything, like a hot knife through butter. You just need to give it enough time.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, I was something that I had in notes for a previous episode where one thing I really don't like about the current Trencher lists is I don't like giving up as much of the agency in the game that you do in those lists because a lot of the list involves like you position in the sort of like use the clouds and have to do a lot of standoff. And so I feel for my playstyle, it gives up too much initiative to my opponent. And at the higher tables, I think that becomes a real problem because you're giving an edge to somebody who can really take advantage of it. Well, and that's why I wasn't that enamored with the long gun, with the trench for long gunners, because they're a solid unit. It's just I don't like having to basically be back, you know, move up, then start backing away to keep them functioning. You know, your opponent, if they have aggressive melee pieces, can force you to squander a lot of territory, which also means you're squandering a lot of scoring opportunities and testing.
I think the one thing that hasn't been that I haven't seen you drop on the table lately is Haley 3 Gravediggers. But honestly, like, I'm really loath to recommend that as well. One, because you don't like taking a relatively passive posture. But two, also for someone with, avowed clock problems, like, that's probably going to get you into more hot water than it bails you out of, you know, because the list is very time intensive to play.
Right. And, you know, I have played that list. It's just I'm not like a super fan of Haley 3 for my own personal reasons. I think she's actually a really good caster. I just doesn't suit my play style as well. And so that's also part of the equation. It's not like Signar's a bad faction by any stretch of the imagination. Clearly, it's just that for what I'm doing right now with it, I'm not exceedingly happy with it. So I'm looking for something that suits what I'm looking for more.
Fair. So I guess that's it for where we're at on lists and checking in on what we're playing, how we're viewing the game, what sort of challenges we're thinking about, and sort of an insight into our little meta and the kinds of challenges we're going up against on a weekly basis.
Thank you for listening to Dominate for Two. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Got a question or an episode idea? Email us at dominatefor2.podcast@gmail.com. We'll be right back.